fly between 10,000, 11,000, and 9,000 feet.
It's September 2nd, 1998, and Swiss Air Flight 111 is in trouble. The cockpit is filling with smoke. The captain is doing everything he can to find the cause, but everything checks out. Then, an alarm sounds. The autopilot shuts down. The electrical systems cut out, one by one.
Swiss Air 111 Heavy is declaring emergency.
What happened next would change aviation history. I'm Les Stroud. I've survived some of the deadliest environments on Earth, but there are some things that even I might not walk away from. This is Deadly Disasters. Today, the crash of Swiss Air Flight 111. It's an overcast Wednesday evening in the village of Fox Point, near Blandford, Nova Scotia. Bob Conrad, a tuna fisherman, arrives home after a good long day at sea. It's time to kick up his feet and relax.
Good evening. It's September 2nd.
And that's what I did. I just collapsed on the couch and the TV was on and it was only a matter of moments and I was gone.
After a long day at sea, Bob's rest is well earned. As he catches some shut-eye, he has no idea that he'll be needed back on the water before the night is out.
Sarah Flight 111 is now ready for boarding.
Meanwhile, at 8 p.m. in Terminal 3 at JFK International Airport, New York, 215 passengers and 14 crew members board Swiss Air Flight 111. No one has any idea that they are about to fly into the history books. Journalist Stephen Kimber knows that book well. He wrote it.
The flight was considered a UN run, right? I mean, it was used by the United Nations to go back and forth Geneva to New York on a regular basis. That was an informal kind of thing, but it was felt that it was a plane that was for the higher end, the higher class passengers.
Please store your luggage in the overhead bin or under the seat in front of you.
UN officials, renowned scientists, international business people, university students and others casually take their seats like they've done countless times before.
Excuse me, is this my seat?
16-year-old Tara Featherhoff is one of the passengers. She's smart, independent, and excited for new adventures at a prestigious boarding school in the Swiss Alps. While Tara is off to explore the world, 24-year-old Stephanie Shaw is returning home. Her father, Ian, a retired Swiss watch company executive, expects to pick her up at the Geneva airport in the morning. Ian Shaw remembers.
Stephanie was in an apartment of her own in the town of Geneva, where we were living in Switzerland, and she was in her final year at Geneva University. Stephanie had gone to New York for 4 days, I believe, and she phoned on the evening before she was due to arrive to say she was staying an extra day, which put her on board Swiss Air 111.
Clear to delivery, this is Swiss Air Flight 111. Information Charlie, PEE154 Hotel.
In the cockpit of Flight 111, Captain Urs Zimmermann runs through the pre-flight checklist. The people on the flight couldn't be in better hands. A Swiss Air veteran of 27 years, Zimmermann is one of the airline's most experienced pilots. He's also a family man, with 3 children back in Switzerland waiting for him to come home. Journalist Stephen Kimber.
It was his 50th birthday, and it was a big celebration that his wife was planning for to celebrate that. He was a veteran pilot. He was not only considered a good pilot from the point of view of being a pilot, he was good enough to train other pilots.
So was his co-pilot, 36-year-old First Officer Stephen Lowe. Stephen recently moved his wife and 3 children into a brand new house.
Swiss Air 111, you're clear for takeoff. Contact departure control, airport.
Swiss Air Air 111, clear for takeoff.
Once the plane is in the air, the passengers settle in for a quiet, comfortable overnight trip.
The first part of the flight was uneventful. Nothing untoward would have been going on. Immediately they would have started to serve the first meal. People would have been choosing their wines and, you know, the food would have been coming out.
The passengers don't have a concern in the world. And why would they? Swiss Air is known as one of the world's safest airlines.
Swiss Air was a very big player in the international airline, and it had a great reputation for safety, for service.
What would you like for dinner?
In a little over an hour, all of that will change. It's Wednesday, September 2nd, 1998, just after 10 p.m. Atlantic time. Swiss Air Flight 111 is right on course, 40 minutes into its flight to Geneva. As it enters Canadian airspace, air traffic controllers in Moncton, New Brunswick, guide her eastward towards the Atlantic Ocean.
Would you like a hot towel?
Up in business class, 16-year-old Tara Featherhoff is getting into a movie on her personal in-flight entertainment system. This is new technology, the first of its kind. It allows passengers to enjoy their own entertainment, browse the internet, even gamble from the comfort of their seats. Stephen Kimber explains.
Swiss Air, as with a number of other airlines, were experimenting with in-flight entertainment systems. Very sophisticated, very state-of-the-art. And so what that meant was that there were a lot of wires that were going here, there, and everywhere, because essentially what you had is a computer under every seat.
The truth is, Swiss Air is still working out the kinks. The heat generated by this new system sometimes causes hard drives under the passenger seats to fail.
The safety concerns that existed beneath the surface. In other words, your average consumer would not have known anything about them. But it didn't seem to raise the kind of flags that clearly in retrospect would have been useful.
The passengers are unaware of any problems, but up in the cockpit, it's a different story. (laughs) 10:12 p.m., 53 minutes after takeoff. The pilots start to smell something unusual. Captain Zimmerman figures out what it is. Smoke. Any amount of smoke on an airplane is a bad sign, and the flight crew know that. The pilots immediately start looking for a cause. They find nothing in the aircraft's electronics compartment. The smoke eventually disappears, leaving only a strong odor. Captain Zimmerman does not alert air traffic control. Yet.
Checklist, avionics smoke.
Instead, he begins a systematic electronic safety check for smoke in the cockpit, as required by Swiss Air. Every system is checked, one circuit at a time. It's a process that could take 20 to 30 minutes. But less than a minute later, the smoke reappears, and this time, there's more of it. By now, it's been 3 minutes and 18 seconds since the smoke was first discovered. Co-pilot Stephen Lowe contacts air traffic control in Moncton, New Brunswick.
Swiss Air, 111 Heavy is declaring pan. We have smoke in the cockpit.
Pan is the code word for a serious problem, but not yet an emergency.
Request immediate return to a convenient place, I guess Boston.
You say to Boston you want to go? But would you prefer to go into Halifax?
Stand by. Affirmative for Swiss Air 111 Heavy. We prefer Halifax from our position.
So Swiss Air 111, roger. Proceed direct to Halifax.
This is no easy decision. Halifax may be closer than Boston, about 60 miles from the plane's current position, but that may be too close. Do they have enough room to descend for a safe landing? Maybe not, but with the unexplainable smoke pouring into the cockpit, they need to get on the ground as soon as possible.
Passengers, please return to your seats and fasten your seatbelts.
Co-pilot Stephen Lowe reduces altitude by a staggering 4,000 feet per minute. Captain Zimmerman slows him down. At that rate, the flight attendants won't have time to prepare their passengers for landing.
Attention, in-charge flight attendant, please report to the flight deck.
Captain Zimmerman sends word to Chief Flight Attendant René Oberhansley of the conditions in the cockpit and their new plan of action. René's training kicks in. He briefs the other attendants and prepares for what's to come. At this point, air traffic control passes from Moncton to Halifax International Airport. Halifax Control radios co-pilot Stephen Lowe in the cockpit.
Swiss Air 111, good evening. Descend to 3000. The altimeter is 2979.
We would prefer at the time around 8000 feet, 2980, until the cabin is ready for landing.
It's been 8.5 minutes since the pilots first smelled smoke in the cockpit. All their efforts are now focused on getting this plane on the ground, fast. Halifax Control informs the captain and first officer that they'll be landing on the airport's longest runway.
Okay, it's a back course approach for runway 06. You've got 30 miles to fly to the threshold.
We need more than 30 miles.
Swiss Air 111, roger. You can turn left heading 306 to lose some altitude.
Flight 111 needs to lose altitude quickly. Air traffic control sends the plane on a 360-degree course. First Officer Lowe grabs the controls and banks hard, essentially flying his wide-bodied aircraft in a circle as it descends lower and lower. The cockpit crew has one more problem to deal with before they can land. They are 22 tons over the maximum weight recommended for a safe landing. It's still possible, but incredibly risky given their rapid descent. They need to dump some fuel, fast. Co-pilot Lowe confers with air traffic control.
We must dump some fuel. May we do that in this area during our descent?
Roger, are you able to take a turn back to the south, or do you want to stay closer to the airport?
Okay, we're ready for a left or right turn to the south to dump.
The pilots have a choice to make. Dump the fuel over land that could be populated, or double back, out to the open sea. Without knowing the cause of the smoke, delaying landing for even a minute is high risk. But the ocean is only 10 miles away, and they'd still be within 25 miles of the airport. Journalist Stephen Kimber explains Captain Zimmerman's ultimate decision.
The decision is to dump fuel in the ocean and then try to make the landing so that it would be a safer landing with reduced fuel. And it's at that point that they fly out over St. Margaret's Bay.
Through the smoke and tension, Captain Zimmerman continues to go through the emergency checklist, carefully following procedures to track down the source of the smoke in the cockpit. Zimmerman flips a special smoke switch that turns electrical circuits off and on one-third at a time. This is a test designed to isolate a problem area.
Generator one, off, off. Generator two, off, off.
10:24 p.m., Atlantic Daylight Time. Suddenly, Swiss Air Flight 111 systems begin to shut down. First to go is the autopilot. Captain Zimmerman immediately notifies air traffic control.
Swiss Air 111, at the time we must fly manually. Are we cleared to fly between 10,000, 11,000, and 900,000 feet?
Swiss Air 111, you can block between 5,000 and 12,000 feet if you wish.
Okay. In the cockpit, the MD-11's electrical systems are failing, one after the other, in rapid succession. The airplane is shutting down. The situation is dire. The pilots radio Halifax Air Traffic Control.
Swiss Air 111 Heavy is declaring emergency. 11 Heavy, we started dump now. We have the land immediately.
Swiss Air 111, just a couple of miles. I'll be right with you.
Roger, and we are declaring emergency now. Swiss Air 111.
Copy that, Swiss Air 111. You are cleared to commence your fuel dump on track and advise me when your fuel dump is complete. Swiss Air 111, check. You are cleared to start your fuel dump.
Okay. 10:26 p.m. Communication with air traffic control is dead. All electronics are out. Displays and instrumentation are shut down. Captain Zimmerman and First Officer Lowe are on their own and flying blind. The cockpit starts to cook. The ceiling above and behind the pilot seats has become so hot that the aluminum frame is melting. Liquefied plastic drips to the floor below. Outside, the night sky is cloaked in heavy cloud. There are no visual markers to help the pilots navigate. Journalist Stephen Kimber describes the flight conditions.
The plane was in total darkness. And what we think may have happened to the pilots is that they become disoriented. They lose because they don't have any instruments to go by.
Swiss Air Flight 111 is going down. The 7-year-old McDonnell Douglas MD-11 slices through the air at high speed. As it passes over the community of Blandford, Nova Scotia, its circular path takes it out to open sea. 600,000 pounds of wide-bodied aircraft plunges toward the water. Its 229 passengers and crew are plummeting at more than 650 kilometers per hour. At the split second of impact, the plane's exterior shatters like an eggshell, its tail telescoping forward into the nose.
I had the expectation that many people would have that, you know, if you crash into water, water is more forgiving. But the reality is that it is like crashing into concrete. Basically, the nose hits and it stops. And within that quarter, half second, the rest of the plane would have arrived there. It's impossible to survive something like that.
Meanwhile, at air traffic control in Halifax, Swiss Air Flight 111 disappears off the radar screen. It's 10:31 p.m. September 2nd, 1998, 10:31 p.m., Swiss Air Flight 111 bound for Geneva from New York just declared an emergency over the waters off Nova Scotia. Then it disappeared from air traffic control's radar screens.
Breaking news. Swiss Air Flight 111 has disappeared in the waters near Blandford, Nova Scotia.
In Fox Point, Nova Scotia, fisherman Robert Conrad jolts awake on the couch after only a few hours of sleep. It's a moment he'll never forget. Conrad remembers.
Television was on, and in a very peculiar way, was awakened by the report of a suspected air crash. And I remember hearing the word Blandford, and I began to awaken rather quickly at that point. So then it was a matter of notifying my wife that I had to go back out to sea.
Thank you. By the time Conrad steers his boat out of St. Margaret's Bay, rescue operations are well underway. Choppers, P-3 Orion prop planes, and a bevy of fishing boats are searching for survivors in an area southwest of the harbor.
The P-3 Orions were releasing flares, and so the sky had a kind of an eerie sense about it with these orange flares, you know, lighting up the sky, and it was overcast and just a rough night to be out there. Only a short period of time passed after we were there that it became clear that survivors weren't going to be found.
Robert Conrad slowly guides his boat through the endless field of debris. Journalist Stephen Kimber explains.
This plane shattered into millions of bits. Some of them were an inch or a quarter of an inch big.
Floating among the wreckage are the remains of all 229 people aboard Swiss Air Flight 111.
People are starting to take aboard parts of bodies. And this was not, you know, for Robert Conrad or for any of the other fishermen, what they'd expected when they went out there. And so it was very traumatizing.
Robert Conrad spots something in the water.
My spotlight fell on what I thought was a doll that had, you know, been part of somebody's luggage. And so I maneuvered the boat over beside this doll, only to realize that it wasn't a doll at all. It was a young child, and I was able to reach down and get the child and place it on the deck of my boat. It was quite an experience to hold that child in your arms and realize that no one in the family would ever do that anymore. That night was a long night, and before it became daylight, it started to rain, and it just added to the bleakness and the sadness of that night.
As a new day arrives, news of the crash reaches the victim's family and friends. In Switzerland, Ian Shaw hops out of bed, eager to hear about his daughter Stephanie's trip to New York.
I woke the next morning around 6, and there was a news flash on television saying that a flight had gone down in the ocean. And I knew that Stephanie was gone. The only thing I can liken it to is being hurled off a precipice in the dark, and you are falling for a very long time, and you can't understand what has happened, and why are you in this very altered state of falling through darkness? And obviously, when you land, you are completely broken, smashed.
Barbara and Mark Featheroff are expecting a call from their daughter, Tara, to say she's arrived safely in Geneva. Stephen Kimber.
Mark got up, I guess it would have been very early that morning. She hadn't called. He went down to the computer just to look up information on the flight's arrival, and he went to the Swiss Air site, and that's where he found the message that the plane had crashed. He essentially collapsed at the computer. And his wife, who was waiting for him to return, come back to the bedroom and tell him that, you know, Tara was okay, that the plane had landed, everything was fine, came down and found him there and found the message on the computer screen. So you can imagine just how traumatizing that would have been.
The investigation into the crash of Swiss Air Flight 111 is conducted by the Transportation Safety Board of Canada. Crews recover an estimated 2 million pieces of debris from the site of the crash, some as small as a dime. Eventually, 98% of the plane is found, each fragment a potential clue to what caused the crash. It takes 5 years and over 350 investigators to complete the investigation and publish the report. Finally, in February 2003, the Transport Safety Board reveals their results. The cause of the crash? A short circuit in the entertainment system caused a fire in the cockpit. That shut down navigation and communication. The pilots were left flying blind and could not contact air traffic control. Though Swiss Air had removed the entertainment systems long before, the company still goes bankrupt after September 11th, 2001. 2 years before the report is made public. In the years since the crash of Swiss Air Flight 111, changes in airline construction have been made based on the Safety Board's report. Action has been taken on 20 of the board's 23 recommendations. Air travel is now safer. But security has come at the cost of 229 lives. Today, their sacrifice is commemorated by two monuments in Nova Scotia, one on either side of St. Margaret's Bay. Visitors who stand before the gray stone sentinels reflect on the lost souls who perished, all because of a faulty in-flight entertainment system, a luxury that we take for granted today. This episode of Deadly Disasters was produced by Ajit Parkal and Miklas Perlis for Storios. Adapted for audio by Craig Colby and sound designed and mixed by Brian Eimer at Images and Sound. This podcast is adapted from the television series Disasters of the Century. Our executive producer is Ron Getz and our supervising producer is Robert Lachlan. Deadly Disasters is a production of Partners in Motion. I'm Les Stroud.